Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. This is Bob Barber, your host here at SAT Radio, SECAM Tribe. Tonight we have Judicial Review. It's a pre-recorded law class for tribal courts by our instructor, Judge Naidu. Does anyone have any questions or comments or suggestions? Go ahead. You're on the air. Give you a couple more seconds here to get your coffee or tea or whatever, Coke, paper, and writing pen. It's a good class tonight. All right, let the class begin. This is Judicial Review.
From Hong Kong.
Yes, morning, Judge.
Okay, let's talk about an interesting topic today, judicial review, and what it means, what it can do for us, what it can do for you, what it can do for a litigant who's challenging a particular law. Now, we are recording this, right, Tom?
Yes, we're recording.
Has everybody got their notes?
No.
A number of people downloaded. Anybody have a problem with bringing up the notes?
So I would imagine everybody has received the notes. Okay, moving on. Now, what is judicial review in the United States like anywhere else in the world? Sorry. Now, it says it's the constitutional ability of a court to examine and decide if a statute, a treaty, or an administrative regulation contradicts or violates the provisions of existing law, the state constitution, or ultimately the United States Constitution. Now, the Supreme Court has declared more than 150 such statutes as unconstitutional. And I can tell you, 18 U.S.C. 1151, 1152, 25 U.C. U.S.C. 1301 are not among them. Okay? But basically, it's the function of the judiciary to interpret the law. The legislature makes the law. The executive enforces the law through the police power, and of course the judiciary interprets and applies the law. Now, this is a curious situation here under the doctrine of the separation of powers. See, the Constitution does not really afford the power of judicial review, although Alexander Hamilton had mentioned it in the Federalist 78. Now, the Federalist Papers are important for everyone to know because the Constitution gets its guidance from the Federalist Papers. This was when John Jay, who became the first Chief Justice, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison were writing letters in the press under pseudonyms. They called themselves Publius, and they called themselves all kinds of Roman names, because at that time sedition against the United Nations, against England's government was a serious crime. You could hang for sedition. So the revolutionary spirit, the revolutionary mind, the revolutionary mindset began with the writings of these three champions, and which were collected to be now popularly known as the Federalist Papers. Now, in Federalist number 78, Hamilton had written that it is entirely the province of the judiciary to tell us what the law is. So it doesn't imply, insinuate that judicial review is necessarily an upshot of that. If your job is to tell me what the law is, then you have to interpret the law. But they interpreted that guidance to mean we can also say if the law is unconstitutional.
Oh.
So that the legislature can amend it or repeal it. So that was the thinking then, and that is the thinking now. But of course, now everybody works for Wall Street. Our judges, our president, our congressmen, they all work for Wall Street. If you read John Talbot's book, the 86 Lies Told to You by Wall Street, John R. Talbot's book, you will see in page 16 that it says Wall Street owns the government. They are the ones who decide how much money a presidential candidate will get. And then after Citizens versus the Federal Elections Commission, there was no more cap on how much a corporation or an individual can contribute. So we need to look at judicial review through the lens of what it was like in 1776, 1976, when Buckley versus Vellio was decided, and in 2015, what is the power of judicial review? Now, I've gone on to say that one can suppose that this could be an effective check and balance of the other organs of state, that is, the legislature, the executive, and by the judiciary, of course. Now, check and balance, if a judicial decision is very broad, vague, ambiguous, and not in line with political or public policy philosophy, the legislature is free to overrule the Supreme Court with newer legislation. If the president doesn't like what the judiciary said and what the legislature did, the president issues an executive order. Now, next week we'll be looking at executive orders. They have no constitutional anchor. It is a convention that became a rule, and now it became binding law. We will be examining Article 2, where the president's power has been translated, transformed from the use of the word the executive power, like judicial power, like legislative power. The legislature can make any law it wants, provided the people wanted that law to be made. Here's the rub. We have what's known as a republican form of government, where instead of our voices being heard in the legislature, we have our elected bozos, idiocrats, represent us in Congress. There are 535 of them. 435 in the House of Representatives and 100 senators. Are they representing the people's expectations? I don't think so, because they are career politicians. They want to, Strom Thurmond, he was in the legislature for almost 50 years. The senator from North Carolina? Strom Thurmond. He didn't even know if he was coming and going. He literally died at the wheel. He went into Congress in 1948. So when we look at this issue of judicial review, and mind you, we are a nation of laws. We're not a nation of men and women. That's the mantra in Washington, D.C. When anything goes wrong, we'll say, Hillary Clinton said that, and Ted Cruz said that, and Mark Rubio said this, and Donald Trump said that, and Ben Carson said this, and John McCain said that, but we are a nation of laws, not of men and women. Well, who made the bloody laws? The law didn't make the law. It's men and women who made the law. Men and women who claimed they were representing the people. How is your land rights being protected? How is your right to be a fair hearing under the 14th Amendment? How is that being protected in non-judicial foreclosure states? So what do you mean we're a nation of laws? We're a nation of flaws, FLAWS. We make so many mistakes, usually fatal to the homeowner. So we got a lawmaker, a law enforcer, and a law interpreter. And the law interpreter's work gets easy when they say this law is unconstitutional. Well, so if the court has said that, will the police be able to, will the sheriff not be in a position to evict you? Usually, yes. If you win the case, the sheriff just goes away. The sheriff bows down to the will of the judge. Now, then the case is appealed. And then that judge is overruled. Now, the sheriff is bound to obey the higher court. So he comes and terrorizes you and tells you you've got 3 to 5 days to move. Now, then you appeal it. Now, it's in appeal. There is a stay of execution. And now, the sheriff goes home and says, all right, I'll wait when you bozos finish your yo-yo actions. You know, one time you say, throw him out. Next time you appeal, let him stay. Throw him out, let him stay. Throw him out, let him stay. So the system stinks. Essentially, that's what our laws are all about. Why do you make a law that can be declared unconstitutional? We would like a law to be declared unconstitutional, although the constitutionality of declaring it unconstitutional is by itself unconstitutional. There's nothing in the Constitution that talks about judicial review. You know, so that's where we are. We are stuck. We are stuck in a very awkward metaphysical corner of a universe which is supposed to be a square, and they throw us into a circular room and say, shut up and sit in the corner. So this is what is happening with the executive, the legislature, the judiciary, and the power of judicial review. Now, you must know that the Supreme Court doesn't have police powers. It doesn't have enforcement powers. So when you talk about the doctrine of the separation of powers, for my decision to be enforced, I got to have police power. Why am I depending on the on the executive, who has a right to overrule my decision because he doesn't like it. Because, well, they don't say we don't like it. They say it is politically incorrect. And as far as public policy is concerned, it's impractical. We can't let you chaps be running around claiming this to be Indian country. We can't let you chaps say you can't build that pipeline because it's an Indian country. I mean, we have oil. We need oil. Who the hell are you to say this is Indian country? Then I say repeal 18 U.S.C. 1151. Why give me a power and then say, well, you know, that's immaterial. It's irrelevant. That's your federal rules of evidence. Rule 401. You raise an issue in court, the judge says it's irrelevant. But, Your Honor, this is relevant to prove my point that the government is in conspiracy to take away my rights. Well, do you have any proof? I was trying to adduce that evidence and proof, Your Honor, and you said that it is irrelevant. Well, what you're saying is irrelevant. How the hell am I going to prove anything if you keep saying it's irrelevant? Welcome to the land of the free and the home of the brief. Where the referee becomes the umpire and the umpire becomes the referee. That's why when the court of first instance, the judge is a referee. Now, when you go and appeal it, those judges are the umpires. There is a difference, you know, between a referee and an umpire. A referee has the power to blow a whistle whenever he wants to cry foul. The umpire, can overrule that whistle. So, if you don't have the power to enforce, like we have the same situation, we can prove that the foreclosing entity doesn't have the power to foreclose because they cannot evidence superior title. We have the law on our side, 18 U.S.C. 1151, but we don't have a police force to enforce it. When the sheriff comes to evict you, we need about 50 of our people telling the sheriff, pack up and leave, or you get arrested. Won't that be nice? We don't even have 50 people in one particular state who can sign up. But that's another story for another day. So, if the Supreme Court cannot enforce its judgment and it has to depend on the executive, where the hell is the check and balance? If the judiciary's job and function is to interpret the law and declare the law through judicial review, is that a check and balance if the other two organs of state decide to overrule the judiciary? So where does it stop? It stops. Your chin stops where my nose begins. So the answer to all of that is for we the people to stand together and stand united as a unified force. We are the people who ordained and established this constitution in order to form a more perfect union. So what the government is doing is not perfect. We the people have the power to create, ordain, and establish a more perfect union. What are we the people doing? I have no idea. Now, in the second part, I say, as the scholars would also say, well, the Constitution does not, you see that, explicitly define a power of judicial review. The authority for judicial review has been inferred from the structure, provisions, and history of the Constitution, specifically the Federalist number 78. Now, Marbury versus Madison was not the first court, was not the first case to decide if an act of Congress was constitutional. The Carriage Act of 1794 imposed a carriage tax. You pay for the vehicle, you pay for what the vehicle is carrying, because it is a public road. Now, mind you, those days they didn't have streets with tarmac and what have you. In 1794, a wagon, a carriage, they imposed the carriage tax. Now, the plaintiff complained, or his claim was that the tax was unconstitutional. The Supreme Court decided that the carriage tax was not unconstitutional. Now, mind you, this is way before your 18 U.S.C. 1151. 1994, the treaty-making process with Native Americans was prolific. Yeah. They signed 250 treaties. The Carriage Act may have been addressed to commerce. What if the traveling in Indian country was a leisure and pleasure and not a measure of commerce? Naidu says. Naidu translation. What were they thinking when they said the Carriage Act was constitutional? Revenue. The government has a right to tax. So, now mind you, this is before the 16th Amendment. So when the Supreme Court said it was constitutional, Congress has the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises. Well, it didn't take long. 9 years later, Marbury versus Madison came about, and the rest is history, as we say. Chief Justice John Marshall said it was the Supreme Court's responsibility to overturn unconstitutional legislation because of the sworn oath of office to uphold the Constitution. And here he referred to the Federalist number 78. The interpretation of the law is the proper and peculiar province of the courts. So now Marshall was saying, we have taken an oath to uphold the Constitution. Fast forward. Escape to the future. Let's take a look at what's happening in Alaska, Arizona, California, Colorado, Idaho, Maryland, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, Nevada, New Mexico, North Carolina, Oregon, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, Virginia, Washington, West Virginia, along with the 51st state, District of Columbia. Now, these are states where the non-judicial foreclosure proceedings take place, when a clerk of the court can issue a foreclosure notice. You just go to court and say, oh, by the way, I have a piece of paper here. We need to evict Naidu and his family and all these guys, you know. Oh, okay. He issues a letter. Now this idiot takes a letter to the sheriff. The sheriff is there with his pot belly, having you take all your personal effects and skedaddle out of there within 3 days. And these are the very same idiots who take a who take an oath to uphold the Constitution. And this is how I've been fighting the state court judges in California, saying, you took an oath to uphold the Constitution. And now you're giving creditor relief to an unconstitutional law. You are violating your oath of office. Usually, they will turn around and say, what do you want me to do? You do nothing till the California legislature has amended the law. especially for all those of you in California. Read up California Civil Code 2924. You'll get a heart attack. But don't get a heart attack. Give them a heart attack. California Civil Code 2924 says anyone, without even evidencing a copy of the mortgage note, can go to a clerk of the court and get a foreclosure notice. Very simple. So, coming back to the great Chief Justice Marshall, who had 6 weeks of training as a lawyer. Well, he was a brilliant law student. He had a natural capacity to grasp the facts within 5 minutes and decide how to issue a verdict or an outcome of the case. But if Marshall is saying that the power to declare an act of Congress unconstitutional is the power of the courts, that power given by the oath I took to uphold the Constitution, then these judges who are issuing non-judicial foreclosure rulings through their clerks of court are violating their oath of office. And therefore, they can be cited for contempt, and they can be hauled up with the Judicial Conduct Commission. I complained about 26 judges, and they threw me out of the American Judges Association. See how democratic America is? When I proved that this judge was violating and not upholding the Constitution that she and he signed and swore, they said, oh my God, this guy is a troublemaker. We need to get rid of him. Well, they didn't make me a judge, so I didn't care. They wanted my $300 every month, every year. So I received some publications from them here and there. So we got to look at judicial review in a measured, in a very careful way, because what they say is not what they mean, and what they mean is not what they say, and there are no enforcement powers, although they take pride that we have held 176 acts of the U.S. Congress as unconstitutional. So I need somebody to go into the Constitution of the United States, Congressional Research Services, and find 176 acts. Aiden Udane, are you here? Is Aiden and Udane there, Tom?
Doesn't look like it.
Okay, we need to research and find out what that 176 acts of Congress that were declared unconstitutional. It's in page 3.
Right.
Now let's look a little bit at the history of how judicial review came about. It all started with the Judiciary Act of 1789. Which established the lower federal courts and identifying and establishing and ordaining and specifying the details of federal court jurisdiction. Okay? So, it's a straightforward research. Some of you can do it. If you don't want to do it, I'll do it. That's okay. We want to get people involved in this who are in this class. All right, so now Section 25 of the Judiciary Act is a very powerful, is a very tell-all, it's a very revealing, illuminating act, a section, where it allowed the U.S. Supreme Court to hear appeals from state courts when the state court decided that a federal statute was invalid. or when the state court upheld a state statute against a claim that the state statute was repugnant to the Constitution. So now, this is the time when the 10th Amendment became a vanguard for state rights. So certain rights that are not shall not be denied or disparaged to the people and to the states. So Section 25 was a subtle way of trying to circumvent the 10th Amendment. So the Judiciary Act allowed a appeal from a state court when the state court decided that the state's rights were in jeopardy. It gave the Supreme Court the power to review state court decisions involving the constitutionality of both federal statutes and state statutes. So Section 25, mind you, here we have a situation where a federal law is at odds with a Bill of Rights. You know, it's strange that people don't see the trees for the forest here. Hang on a minute. There have been a lot of situations where a federal statute is staring at the eyes and concentrating on the mid-brow of one of your 10 amendments. And that's sad. That's sad when a federal court says, I can overrule a state court decision if the federal statute is challenged. Today, we have what's known as, Aiden has got the research done for the, he's online. Let me send you the copy of this. Aiden, if you can hear me, can you send it to, everybody in the tribal law classroom? There's something wrong. Good job, son. Good job. Okay, so there we have it, folks. Hang on a minute. I'll send it to you.
It's not there yet.
Okay, let me see if I can send this to everybody in tribal law. Let's see. Okay, sent it to the tribal law. Page.
I will do that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is downloading. It says so. So it'll be interesting to see what laws were declared unconstitutional.
Very
interesting. Say again?
44 pages.
Yes. Good job, Aidan. Thank you. Okay, going back to... now, you, I want all of you who's attending the class to research that, because it can affect your rights. So you've got to know what was held unconstitutional and what these idiots are claiming is constitutional. Okay? So the Judiciary Act, you can make a note that it was an affront to the 10th Amendment. Where they decided that, you know, you are sovereign as a state, but not as sovereign as my federal statute is concerned. If it's unconstitutional, I will overrule it. So, so court decisions from 1788 until Marbury versus Madison. Judicial review was employed in both federal and state courts. A detailed analysis has identified 31 state or federal cases during this time in which statutes were struck down as unconstitutional. Now, you can find that in the research that we just sent you, okay? But one judge who concluded that the statute was unconstitutional was, well, not really a judge, a professor, William Traynor. The sheer number of these decisions not only belies the notion that the institution of judicial review was created by Chief Justice Marshall, it reflects the widespread acceptance and application of the doctrine. Well, that's because the legislature did nothing to overrule Marshall. What's stopping the legislature from making a new law? I mean, look at Duro versus Rena, which defanged exclusive tribal jurisdiction, exclusive criminal tribal jurisdiction. And the legislature was forced to introduce amending law, which became 25 United States Code 1301, to further expand the scope of 18 U.S.C. 1152. So judicial review, all said and done, is not really something that is cast in stone, because before the concrete can set, a new concrete mixer comes and throws newer concrete on that. So I'm saying it's not altogether correct to say that Marshall created the doctrine of judicial review, because Alexander Hamilton wrote about this. And Marshall just simply applied it to full force. Now, let's take this one step further and let's look at the celebrated case of Worcester versus Georgia. Here, Marshall said Cherokees had absolute tribal jurisdiction in Cherokee territory. So the decision was in favor of the Cherokees. Andrew Jackson reportedly said, Chief Justice has declared the law, now let him enforce it. There was no way he could enforce it. So what did Jackson do? He sent in the federal troops and ordered all Cherokees removed from Georgia. That's how you get your Trail of Tears. Freedom, liberty. When the Supreme Court said that this is Indian land, Andrew Jackson, $20 bill man, said, no, you can enforce it. I will enforce my law. So he came and said, listen, we need Georgia fertile land. All of you, get out. Oh, by the way, give them some blankets. Don't forget the anthrax. That's free. So here we are going around the world, hanging this guy and that guy for war crimes. How do we hang these idiots who sit in the White House for genocide they perpetrated on my people? Anthrax, folks, free. Anthrax, free. Blankets. Who fight for us? Tens of thousands died. So this is a history of our checks and balances. Oh my God, you're right. Oh my God, a million of you are right. We got to kill you. Can't have a million of you fellas running around with tomahawks. Huh? That's very bad for health. Tomahawk law. So what do? We continue doing what we do, which is nothing. Hidden knowledge. All right. Let's look at the Havens case. This is in 1792. So Federal Circuit Court held an act of Congress unconstitutional for the first time, it says, before 1794. Congress, they said, had violated the Constitution by passing an act requiring circuit judges to decide pension applications. Now, this is an interesting case because the circuit court very correctly pointed out that this is not a judicial function. But by the time it went to the Supreme Court, the statute was repealed. All right? So, saved by the bell. Congress repealed it. And there was another case. It was unreported, but somebody dug it up. United States versus Yale Todd. Supreme Court reversed a pension that was awarded under the same pension act that had been at issue in Haven's case. Now, mind you, if they've repealed it, what's the big deal? Well, let's see. The court apparently decided that the act designating judges to decide pensions was not constitutional because this is not a proper judicial function. This apparently was a Supreme Court case, the first Supreme Court case to find an act of Congress unconstitutional. However, there was not an official report of the case, and it was not used as a precedent. Oh, my God. This is interesting to know, because when we are fighting cases and they are quoting law, I mean, they're quoting case after case after case, like precedent common law. This is what common law is. Like they have value. We can quote this to say that this is not altogether right to just claim and claim that this law created by this case is the law of the land. Because it was not reported, therefore it cannot be used as a precedent. I have a few other cases like that. Now then, in 1796, we have Hilton versus the United States. This involved a challenge to the constitutionality of an act of Congress. It was argued that a federal tax on carriages violated the constitutional provision regarding direct taxes. This is the part of that Carriage Act thing. Supreme Court upheld the tax, finding it was constitutional. Now, mind you, this is way before the 16th Amendment, Congress' power to lay and collect taxes. The case was, of course, well publicized at the time, and people understood that the court was testing the constitutionality of an act of Congress. Because it found the statute valid, the court did not have to assert that it had the power to declare a statute unconstitutional. Surprisingly, they did not talk about Article 1, Section 8, or the power of the Congress to lay and collect taxes. Now, then we got the same champion here, Hilton. Ware versus Hilton. This was in 1796, where apparently they, for the first time, struck down a state statute. Whoa, this is heavy. The court reviewed a Virginia statute regarding a pre-Revolutionary War death and found that it was inconsistent with the peace treaty between the United States and Great Britain. Relying on the Supremacy Clause, the court found the Virginia statute invalid. I disagree. Can anybody agree with why I disagree? Anyone? Can you think why I disagree with this? No state shall impair the obligation of a contract, Article 1, Section 10. Oh. Are you with me? Now, think about this for a while. Virginia had a relationship with somebody before the war. Article 1, Section 10 says no state shall impair the obligation of a contract. So, where was Hilton? Is not right, not correctly decided, because the state statute, no state shall invalidate or impair the obligation of a contract. So I disagree with this decision. Just because it's the Supreme Court, it doesn't mean it's right. It was relying on a treaty. Okay, it was relying on a peace treaty. But if you say that the treaty is the supreme law of the land, and then Article 1, Section 10 says no state shall impair the obligation of a contract, we have Article 6, Section 2 contradicting or colliding with Article 1, Section 10. Think about that, folks. Think about that for a while. So, we then move to Hollingsworth versus Virginia. The Supreme Court now says it doesn't have jurisdiction to hear the case because of the jurisdictional limitations of the 11th Amendment. Oh, my God. So this holding would can also be viewed as an implicit finding that the 1789 Judiciary Act was unconstitutional in part. And then The court did not provide any reasoning for its conclusion. See how they get away with it? And it did not say that it was finding the statute unconstitutional. So what is the Supreme Court trying to do? Because at that time, during that period, during that material time, political considerations were more important than the rule of law. Okay, this is all before the fellow with the big kahuna came and said, no, we have the power of judicial review. The last case was in 1800, Cooper versus Telfair, where Justice Chase said it is indeed a general opinion. It is expressly admitted by all this bar, and some of the judges have individually in the circuit, that the Supreme Court can declare an act of Congress to be unconstitutional and therefore invalid, but there is no adjudication of the Supreme Court itself upon the point. Well, there is no adjudication simply because Congress can always overrule the Supreme Court. So what I'm trying to show here is the convoluted reasoning of the Supreme Court, which has no teeth. I'm also trying to tell you what is the point of it all to go to court when these idiots don't follow the law, they don't give reasons. And if at all they give reasons, it is a weak reason that has got no bearing at all. So what's the answer to all of this? People's court, the Seventh Amendment. Once you get a police force, once you got the militia, once you got police power, it's the people's court, because we the people have a right, a constitutional right, to ordain and establish a more perfect union. If the government cannot do it, we the people have that right. I didn't invent it, folks. We have covered this in previous classes. We the people, in order to ordain and establish a more perfect union, we the people, the government cannot create a more perfect union. It's we the people. We the people cannot just be relying on these courts because they give unpopular decisions, especially when the law is on your side. And then you've seen this other case, Ware versus Hilton, where Article 6, Section 2, the Supremacy Clause, is at odds with Article 1, Section 10. No state shall impair the obligation of a contract. So how can you have two conflicting constitutional provisions? No? I had a cartoon once cut and kept aside. Husband and wife over breakfast, husband reading the paper, wife nonchalantly telling the husband, I think we should send our constitution to Iraq. We are not using ours. So what's the point of it all, folks? The answer is we the people. We have all the answers, but we are not doing anything about it. So please, let's do something about it. Let's change the status quo. Let's do something that would make sense. Let's get all this cases that were overruled over the years, all these cases that were said to be unconstitutional, let's read up on acts of Congress held unconstitutional. All this 44 pages. Good research stuff.
Good.
Have a look at it, maybe 5 pages a day. And see what we can do to prove the government wrong again and again and again and again. Very interesting stuff. Act of May 27, 1908. Provision making locally taxable all land of Indians of the 5 civilized tribes, from which restrictions have been or shall be removed, was held a violation of the 5th Amendment in view of the Atoka Agreement, embodied in the Curtis Act of June 28, 1898. Providing tax exemption for allotted lands while title in original LT not exceeding 21 years. Wow. Page 2127. So go through that, and then page 2127. Provisions authorizing certain Indians to institute their suits in the Court of Claims to determine the validity of any acts of Congress passed since 1902. Very interesting. So, any questions, any comments based on what we went through today? How many do we have, Tom?
Let me move my cursor here.
Good. Well, if there are no questions, no comments.
Well, we've got a lot of work to do reading this research, which
may you don't have to read it at one go. Just take 5 pages at one time and
right.
Make notes.
And think about it, right.
Yeah, think about it and see what we can do about it.
Now, that last case you mentioned, that's not in this research, unless the research is not in chronological order.
Yeah, well, sometimes the researchers either deliberately choose not to include a particular case,
okay.
But we don't just stick to one research note.
Okay.
Or no, we just go far and wide to find out what they were trying to do.
Okay, good. Because the last case here was a 1997 case.
Oh, yeah. A lot of things have happened.
Okay, good.
Since 1997, I had a complete list at one time, and then when my computer crashed,
yep.
Everything else crashed. So, okay, if we have no questions, no concerns, email me. And
okay.
Thank you very much for attending.
Thank you very much, Judge.
Okay, all the best. Stay in touch. Bye.
Thank you.